Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there and good morning. Coming up in today's show, the incredible Capuchin monk, Brother Kevin, joins us to talk about Christmas and caring after the most vulnerable at this time of year. Also today, whistleblower Tom Clonan on being reconciled with the Defence Forces, and we'll have some great live music from the one and only Brona Gallagher. Our text number 51551. You can email Miriam at rte.ie and you can find me on Twitter at Miriam O'Call. Good morning, Brona Gallagher. How
Good
are you?
Good morning, Maria. I'm very well. And how are you?
Delighted you're here. I'm always so impressed at people who can sing at this hour, by the way.
Well, we've had 15 lattes. We shouldn't have lattes really because it's milk, but we do drink a lot of caffeine before we come on any show.
Tell Only my caffeine. Listeners who you're here with this morning.
I'm here with the beautiful Conor Brady on guitar and the beautiful Cian Boylan on piano.
And they are indeed beautiful. Now, what are you going to sing for us
They're
first?
They're so beautiful. They're actually getting more beautiful as the summers and the winters pass. We're going to sing a song we wrote that came out this year called Greatest Love. And it's a romantic little Christmas lighting up the sky music.
Off you go.
Greatest, greatest.
Oh, that's beautiful. Brona and Connor and Cian, thanks so much. Thank and you're going to come back and sing later on and chat to me. And of course, next Wednesday, the 11th, you're actually in the Sugar Club at 7:30. Yep. Tickets €20 from sugarclubtickets.com.
That's the one.
Yeah, and I'll mention it again later on. You go have another latte.
We're going to have four more lattes, then we'll get another wee song.
We'll take a break.
Thank you.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Our text number is 51551. You can email Miriam at rte.ie and you can find us on Twitter at Miriam O'Cal. It's a lonely business being a whistleblower, calling out the organisation you often love and being ostracised from your colleagues and being dismissed by the career which had defined your life. It was thus for my next guest, Tom Clonan, a former member of the Irish Defence Forces who 20 years ago was serving in the Irish Army when he began research as part of his PhD in DCU, looking at the experiences of female soldiers. He has since described his interviews and the results of his work as harrowing. 59 out of the 60 female soldiers had experienced traumatic experiences, including bullying, harassment, and sexual assault and rape. Well, last week he was thanked for his work, and the Defence Forces acknowledged how his studies had advanced equality and dignity in the military. And Tom joins me now. Good morning, Tom Clonan.
Good morning, Miriam.
Most of our listeners will be used to, you know, being on radio programmes and TV programmes talking about security issues. Not everyone knows this backstory. So first of all, this is great news for you. You must be really relieved, are you?
Oh, yeah. It's a huge burden has been lifted off my shoulders. I mean, as a younger man, you know, when I started that research all those years ago, we didn't have the term whistleblower. And we certainly didn't have the term whistleblower reprisal. So I had no idea the direction that research would take me into. Yeah, it's been 20 years of isolation, insidious rumour, kind of character assassination. And to get to this point where the Chief of Staff, Mark Mellott, reached out to me and to step forward in this way, it's hugely positive. And I'm conscious, Miriam, that there are other whistleblowers out there, people that I know, friends of mine like Maurice McCabe, who probably, I don't know if they'll ever have this level of reconciliation with the organisation, as you quite rightly say, that they loved. Mm. And so I'm conscious of how unusual this is, but I'm also conscious of the really powerful signal it sends to other organisations, corporations, public and private sector in Ireland, that, you know, the whistleblowing journey doesn't have to end in tears, that organisations can actually embrace disruptive findings within their organisations and learn from them and move forward. And we can share that learning with other organisations to empower people to speak up, and particularly this area of gender-based violence. You know, it's so dark and it's so prevalent in Irish society as it is internationally. It's a huge issue. And, you know, there's a lot to be learned from, you know, that piece of research. And now, after all these years, we can actually, you know, move forward with that and share the learning.
I mean, you were ahead of your time. How did this rapprochement, how did it come about?
Yeah, well, just to kind of put the whole thing in context, I mean, so I went to school. I went to the Christian Brothers in Finglas back in the 80s. I did my Leaving Cert in 1984. And I was really lucky in that I went to Trinity, and I had a really positive experience in Trinity. And I think Trinity College, it really gave me a kind of a professional, intellectual and ethical formation as a young man before I joined the army.
Mm-hmm. What did you study?
So I actually studied education. And I did it all through Irish, which was very...
Eintuck, your father.
Yeah, Eintuck, yes. I think that also means surprising as well as wonderful. that was quite a culture shock. But I'd come from... My grandmother... I think my grandmother was responsible for all this. My grandmother's from Kerry. She was a Gaelgar. She was born in 1900. Mairead na Bheaglaigh. Mairead Begley. She came up to Dublin in 1916 to become a primary school teacher. And she was radicalised by the events of that week. And so she joined Cumann na mBan, and she was a very active member of Cumann na mBan as a student, as a primary school teacher. And she actually joined after the execution of the 1916 leaders. She became quite radicalised by those events. And Louise Gavan Duffy set up Ireland's first Gael school, School Vrija, in Stephen's Green. So my grandmother taught there from 1919 until 1965. Now, she was also at that point attached to the 6th Brigade of the South Dublin IRA. Sorry, 6th Battalion of the South Dublin Brigade of the IRA. And she participated in arson attacks on a number of police stations throughout the South Side, Blackrock, Dundrum, right out to Greystones, quite a number of them. So she was a typical woman, multitasker, primary school teacher by day, arsonist and freedom fighter by night. So she came to live with us when she retired in 1965. I was born in 66. And I suppose essentially she looked after me when I was a nipper.
Yeah.
And, you know, throughout that time, she would have told me about her involvement and the involvement of women in the liberation of the state. So I suppose you could say I grew up in a kind of a matriarchal household. I had three sisters, beautiful and violent. So I knew throughout.
You were terrorised by your sisters.
Yes. And, you know, so I knew definitely that, you know, the potential that women had as citizens. And, you know, so graduating from Trinity, it was something I'd always wanted to do. I got a cadetship and, you know, the proudest day of my life was being commissioned as an officer in 1991, Óglaigh na hÉireann. Troubles were still at their height. The rest of my class went to Galway to do their studies. Some of them went to do flight training. I'd already been in college, so I got a lot of experience very quickly in what we call aid to the civil power operations, armed operations, the support of Garda Síochána. And this is just to show, Miriam, that I was right at the heart of the organisation. I was doing the thing that I loved so much. I then went overseas in 95 to a very violent deployment in Lebanon. During our deployment, the Israelis launched a punitive operation against the people in our area of operations called Operation Grapes of Wrath. And hundreds of innocent Lebanese men, women and children were killed. And I, like other members of that battalion, the 78th Battalion, acted as human shields. We, for that 3 week period of March, April 1996, we, you know, hundreds of children, you know, entire families, grandparents, children, infants were pulled from the wreckage of their houses struck by airstrikes, helicopter gunship attacks. There were thousands and thousands of such attacks in our area. And the effects on those people, you know, limb separation, burns, soft tissue, it was indescribable. And we went through that experience ourselves, but that left absolutely an indelible mark on me. But again, when I returned from Lebanon in 96, I knew something inside me shifted, and I was particularly conscious of the suffering of women and children in that, and the role that women played in the conflict in the Middle East. And then later, when I was in Bosnia, I saw again the role that women played in that conflict and their resilience, their strength, their perseverance, and how their story was very, very seldom told. So for all of those reasons, when I came back in 96, I looked for permission from the director of training, from the general staff, to do a PhD on women's experiences in the Defence Forces. And that's where the research journey started. So again, I suppose as a student, I was a serving officer in the Army. I was a captain in the Defence Forces. So I was supervised not only by DCU, Dublin City University, but I was also supervised and invigilated by the military authorities. So I had to get written permission to carry out all aspects of the research, in addition to having to put the research proposal through the ethics committee in Dublin City University. And Dublin City University were very good. Like, they supervised me, I would say, to within an inch of my life. Mm. Because after the first 2 years of the research, we began to find that the Defence Forces was not an equality-friendly environment in the 1990s. It didn't have an equality mission statement. It was out of step with the international military with regard to policies as they apply to female personnel. And this was a big shock to me, because even though I was in the organisation, you know, I was a young man in a male-dominated organisation. I was an officer. I was fully immersed in the values and norms of the organisation. So I never really stood back and contemplated or reflected on what it was like for my sisters in arms, for my female colleagues. So after 2 years, the registrar of DCU became a little bit concerned about how negative, I suppose, the emerging findings were.
Was that after the interviews you did?
No. And that was the final piece to it. So in 98, the registrar of DCU advised me that I needed to go to the chief of staff and get some sort of a written clarification, or what they refer to as a letter of comfort, to continue the research. I met the chief in 98, a great guy, Lieutenant General Jerry McMahon. Went to his office. I took it as a good sign that he made me a cup of coffee, which was unusual. And I set it out to him, you know, the issues that we were coming across. And he was very, very concerned. He said, look, these are very, very serious findings. You need to cross every T and dot every I in relation to this. So he gave me then a letter of instruction, and in the military, written instructions have the lawful force of orders to continue the research and to, you know, leave no stone unturned was the expression he used, to get to the bottom of it so that the defence forces and the military authorities could rectify the problem. So that's when I began the interview phase, the primary data gathering aspect of the research. So I had to get a maximum variation sample of female personnel, my colleagues. So I interviewed a total of 60 women. Now, at the time, there were only about 250 women in the Defence Forces. So it was quite a quite a large sample. We were hoping it was a representative sample, but it was a maximum variation sample. Interviewed 43 in different units and barracks around the country, Army, Air Corps, Naval Service, and then a control sample of 17 women in the Middle East. So in order to do that, you know, you can't just rock up to an army barracks, even as an officer, and start looking for people to interview. You know, you have to go through the unit commander. You have to go very often through the brigade or the command structure to get permission to go into another army or corps or service to interview people. Those women would have, in many cases, would have been briefed by their commanding officers prior to my arrival to explain what this was about. So everybody in the Defence Forces knew what I was doing. I was completely transparent. I behaved ethically at all times. And I was also supervised by the university, in fact, by both organisations, the university up to the level of registrar and in the Defence Forces right up to the level of chief himself. And that's when it began to really change. When I started to interview those women, my colleagues, I mean, in a discussion of the training environment, because I had no idea about the sexual harassment or sexual violence. I had never been bullied. I had never been sexually assaulted. So therefore, I didn't know that these things existed. So in the conversations we had about the training environment, they began to disclose experiences of the most brutal and traumatic nature of bullying, harassment, sexual assault and rape. 59 of the 60 reported some form. And many of these women told me things that they hadn't told their significant others or their partners or their lovers or their family members. And I would characterise them as being really angry to have been the target of discrimination to begin with, which was, you know, it was an accelerant for the other behaviour. It was an environment where it created a permissive environment where women were subject to hostile scrutiny and subject to this type of targeting.
Were you shocked yourself?
I was. I just, in fact, I went back to DCU to my supervisor and explained to her that the research had taken this direction. And the ethical guidance that we got was that we had to pursue this unanticipated set of outcomes. Like it was the most absolute moral and categorical imperative to pursue this. Like you can provide a moral justification for killing. That's what the army is about. You can provide a moral justification for lying, for theft. But there can be, it is the one thing in our species, you know, sexual assault, sexual violence is the one thing for which there is no ethical or moral. So we had no choice but to pursue this. I reported it to my superiors. Interestingly, many of the women had reported these issues to the military police and to the military authorities, but the reporting structures at the time were just inadequate. And in fact, I think of the 60, 54 expressed no confidence in the reporting structures at the time. And one of the women said to me that her advice to younger female soldiers was that if you're the subject of a sexual assault, report it to an Garda Síochána. Forget about the military police. Go directly to the guards. Because at that time in the 90s, the guards were really beginning to move forward and progress in that area.
So what happened? You interviewed all these women in the army. They came up with these horrendous stories. So what happened then?
So I then finalised the report and I brought those findings forward to the military authorities at Defence Forces headquarters. And at that point, I was a staff officer for the Chief of Staff. I fully enjoyed the support of the organisation right up until that point. I was confident that the findings would be acted upon immediately and they would bring an end to this. Absolutely immediately. And at that point, Miriam, and this is the experience of whistleblowers, I was a valued, respected member of the organisation. It would have been, well, you know, common knowledge in the organisation that I'd participated in a very violent deployment, command of troops overseas in a combat environment. I was very well respected, very well regarded. But the moment I brought forward these findings at the level of the general staff at that point, they reacted very, very badly. And this is where the whistleblower reprisal thing came in. So immediately I was told that the findings were, and I'm sorry to use the word, were bullshit. And other language was used. I was told that I was a rat. I was told that under no circumstances was I to ever refer to this again. And then when the findings found their way into the public domain and there was saturation coverage of the PhD because it was lodged to the library in DCU as per the chief's instructions, so it was on the public record. And after a period of time, it got out, it got saturation coverage.
How did it get out?
Well, there was a freelance journalist, a colleague and a friend of mine. He's a brilliant guy, Declan Power. Mm. He was a part-time lecturer in DCU at the time. He's doing an MPhil. He accessed the PhD. He couldn't believe it. So he broke the story in the Sunday World, and then it extended out into saturation coverage in the broadsheet and then broadcast everywhere. Mm. And immediately the military authorities responded by saying that I had fabricated the findings, that I had carried out the research, that I'd concealed it from them, or I'd somehow hidden it, that I had acted in a sort of a secretive, unethical capacity, which was all completely untrue. Mm. They argued that I'd fabricated the findings, falsified the results and so on in dozens and dozens of media interviews. But the big thing was they said that I had concealed it from them, that I'd hidden it or... But it was a PhD. It was done according to best practice and with all of the oversight that a university brings to bear. I had reported it at all times. But eventually, this led to serious difficulties for me. I had retired from the army. I was pursuing an academic career.
So you had left the army by now?
Yeah, I retired just after in December of 2000. As planned to pursue an academic career. We'd our first baby was born. I needed to have a more family friendly occupation at that point. But this had always been part of the plan. This was the reason why I pursued the PhD in the first place. Because I knew from that experience in Lebanon that I found myself, I suppose, no longer, that something had happened in Lebanon that I just was no longer consistent with military service in that respect. And I had issues around the use of force. But so I was on probation. I was invited to a number of meetings. It was explained to me that I'd been hired on the basis that I had a PhD, but that it was being said on radio and on TV by really important people that I'd made it all up, and that therefore I would be shortly introduced into a HR process where I'd probably lose my job. So I was also threatened by former colleagues that, I'd breached the Official Secrets Act. One senior officer told me that a file was being prepared to the Director of Public Prosecutions, that I'd face criminal prosecution. And so at that point, I thought my reputation was in tatters because of the public statements and the interviews given by the military authorities at the time. I thought I was going to lose my job. I thought I was going to lose my liberty. I was sent to Coventry by former colleagues. I was socially isolated, and that impacted right into the family in the most extraordinary way. We were the subject of a campaign of silent calls, obscene calls, threats. Members of my family were targeted in a similar way. We started to receive obscene texts and phone calls. It was just... But again, we now know that this phenomenon is known as whistleblower reprisal. I knew nothing of this. It all came to a head, and actually... The role that RTE played in this was extraordinary, in that I had no voice, I had no way to respond or answer to these accusations. But the media here were actually very good. The print media, Jim Cusack, who was security editor of the Irish Times, gave me the right to respond and to reply and to elaborate on what had actually happened. And I was actually here in RTE. I did an interview with Ryan Tuberty when he was working at Current Affairs on what was then 5-7 Live, in which we got to tell the story. And Ryan listened to me and allowed me to speak and tell the story. And it came to a head on the News at One and RTE with Sean O'Rourke, where I produced the letters that had been given to me by the Chief of Staff and the Director of Training, which gave the lie to the assertion by the then military authorities that I'd concealed or they knew nothing about it. So that prompted the then Minister for Defence, Michael Smith, this is a long story, to launch an independent public inquiry into the whole study. It was called a study review group. And he actually rang me on my mobile, Michael Smith. He was a Fianna Fáil TD, Minister for Defence, and said, "What? How can we end this saga? How can we rectify matters? I said there has to be an independent inquiry. So the study review group, headed up by a brilliant academic, Dr. Eileen Doyle, investigated the research. It took them 2 years, and in 2003, my findings were fully vindicated. But they also found that not only were women subject and targeted in this way, sexual violence and rape and so on, but also young male soldiers were also subject to that type of assault and rape, particularly in the overseas environment. So it was quite an extraordinary set of findings. And that, I suppose, for me was a vindication of sorts. And it ended some of the difficulties I'd had at that time. But my relationship with the armed forces was never restored, and it was always fragmented. And all over the years, last 20 years, as a security analyst and as an academic, I've still remained in isolation and subject to that kind of rumour mill, that really insidious thing, you know, which questions your integrity and, you know, about your military service and about your academic record. But in June of this year, actually on the 21st anniversary of the day I met the Chief of Staff 21 years ago in June of 1998, 21st anniversary, I got an unexpected but very welcome email from the current Chief of Staff, Mark Mellett, Vice Admiral Mark Mellett. And it was a personal email from him. There was no staff officers involved. He said, look, we need to fix and we need to talk about what's happened between you and the organisation. It's 20 years on. We've moved on. We've matured. We've learned. And we'd like to just sit down face to face and talk about this and see if we can put things to right. And we met in September. It was an extraordinary meeting. A classmate of mine is still serving, Lieutenant Colonel Derek Priestley, came along with me. He hadn't really heard from me for about 20 years. But I said to him, look, I'm having a meeting with the chief. And Derek agreed to come along and just be there as a support and as a listening man. And so the chief was there and a staff officer. And we went through the whole thing. And I knew, actually, within the first 10 minutes of talking to Mark Mellett, that this whistleblower journey was over and that he was keen to share the learning from that with the organisation. And I have to say, to the great credit of the armed forces here, when the study review group reported, the Army implemented all of the findings and recommendations of my research and subsequently the findings of the study review group, to the extent that they're now an exemplar. They're, you know, consistent with international best practices regards dignity in the workplace, diversity, inclusion and equality. And the most important thing in all of this is that it has ended the systematic and systemic gender-based violence within the organisation. Now, you're always going to have incidents and occasions where this will arise, but the Army has made that big leap forward. And what Mark Mellett wants to do, as does Dublin City University, because they got involved in this, Professor Breen McCrae, President of DCU, was delighted with this development. And so the Defence Forces and DCU are going to move forward in a partnership to just really drive forward that diversity and inclusion agenda with Sandra Healy there. She's the head of the Diversity and Inclusion Office in DCU. So it's such a positive outcome. But for me personally, it has allowed me to go back to where I was, you know, as a young guy all those years ago and just reconnect with that organisation so that I have closure and that I can move on. It's been great for my family as well, because it was such a painful experience, because at the height of that whistleblower reprisal, you know, I lost my mum, I lost one of my beautiful sisters died of breast cancer. She was only 42. We lost a little girl, Leiden, little baby girl. My son Owen was diagnosed with a neuromuscular disease. And I'd lost my extended family, my social network. It was just a very, very lonely time. And even now to this day, sometimes I'll hear one of my classmates, perhaps, that a parent has died. And I knew their parents because we were so closely bonded in the organisation through our training, our overseas service and so on. And occasionally I'd hear something like that. And it really hurts because, you know, I'd like to have been there. I'd like to have, you know, extended my sympathy. But Mark Mellett has allowed all of that to come to an end. And it has taught me something as well about resilience, Miriam, because all sorts of life comes knocking on all of our doors, but we have to learn to move forward and when I suppose life carries on, you know, four kids and it's busy. So you just have to keep on and keep going. But there were so many people on the way who really helped, and RTE were great. Like, public service broadcasting is so important. It gives people like me and other people who wish to speak truth to power, they give them a platform. And, you know, to criticise or undermine public service broadcasting is an act of collective self-harm. But and there were so many people here, like Alan Torney, who produced and who did it.
Great, Alan.
And all of the other people. But I would say, this is a moment, though, in Irish society where here's an organisation, the Armed Forces, that has reconnected with a whistleblower. It's such a strong signal to empower other whistleblowers and other organisations to speak up about, whether it's in the corporate sector, IT sector, the multinationals here, in our hospitals. And, you know, it's OK to speak up about wrongdoing. You'll get a hearing. There's a positive ending. And the most important thing, though, Miriam, of all, is when I think back to those years, the women that spoke to me, their courage, their integrity, their resilience, they came into work every day into an environment where they didn't feel welcome, where they suffered, they were targeted in this way, and they continued to serve their country at home and overseas, put on that uniform and be the best that they could be. And that, to me, is the most extraordinary thing. And anything that we can do to combat gender-based violence in the workplace or elsewhere in Irish society, that's the learning that we can bring forward from this.
It's great it's turned out so happy. And how happy was your son Owen about it? Just for my listeners, in case they don't, I know your son Owen.
Yeah.
He's the beautiful young man you mentioned there who was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy. Is that what you
mean? He's got a Pelizaeus Merzbacher disease, a mouthful. It's,
okay.
It's a neuromuscular disease, so yeah. he's a wheelchair user.
He's a wonderful guy.
Yeah, and yes. he actually featured on TG Cahir there during the week.
I saw it.
On Wednesday evening, which is a beautiful, really beautiful documentary from Midas Productions, really, really gorgeous.
But about the importance of guide dogs as well, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And the role that dogs can play in our lives. And Owen Owen is very philosophical.
How old is he now, Owen?
He is 17.
Okay.
So, and he's in fifth year. He's in St. Andrews there, and he's doing his leaving cert, complaining about study and so on. But he's got a great perspective. I mean, obviously, my family unfortunately know the story because of everything that happened. And on my way to meet the chief, Owen said to me from his wheelchair, you know, and his speech is dysarthric, and he said to me, "Remember," he said, "they're not your mates." He said, "Yet," and but I'm happy. Look. It was such a positive, and I'm conscious that, you know, it's unusual in Irish society, but it sends a really strong positive signal. I'm very grateful to Breen McCrae of DCU, very grateful to Mark Mellott, but particularly the learning from this that we can bring forward. Like, the Army recognises that diversity and difference, whether it's LGBTI, gender, sexual orientation, ethnicity, it doesn't matter. Diversity strengthens the armed forces, strengthens the nation. And we've had some speech in our public discourse in the last couple of months about travellers, about people who are different. That is quite negative. We need to stand up for difference and diversity. It's such a powerful thing. It will help Ireland to remain relevant. It'll help Ireland to be global and to have a future. And we really have to speak up for diversity and inclusion and equality, and particularly for our amazing women in all walks of Irish life. That, you know, if we want to realise our potential as a nation, women have to be at the forefront of that.
Well, Tom Clonan, thank you so much for coming in to tell us your story this morning. And I'm delighted for you that it turned out so great in the end.
Thanks, Mary. It's great to be home.
Yeah, absolutely. Take good care of yourself. We'll take a break.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Well, my next guest this morning is a man I often call a saint, because frankly he is. Brother Kevin and all those wonderful people at the Capuchin Day Centre in Dublin City Centre provide food for so many of our homeless and those struggling in this life. The motto is "No one goes hungry." And with the annual Christmas dinner in full preparation mode, Brother Kevin Crowley now speaks to me from Bow Street in the centre of Dublin. Good morning, Brother Kevin.
Good morning, Miriam.
How are you?
Very well, very well. Still alive.
Yeah, listen, I know this, but my listeners may not remember. You began this all back in 1969, didn't you?
I did, yes. We're 50 years now in operation. And I suppose the reason why I started, Miriam, I saw a number of people walking the streets during the daytime and having nowhere to go. And I said to myself then, as we followers of St. Francis, we should really do something about this. And then that is the reason why we started in 1969. And when we started, we had about 50 people then Miriam.
Yeah.
And now each morning we open our doors between 6:30 and 7:00. And we'd have anything from 300 to 350 for breakfast. And we'd have anything from 500 to 600 for dinner. And that's 6 days a week. So that's a huge, huge change from the day we started back in 1969.
That's in a way so frightening, isn't it, brother? Because, I mean, I assume when you began it all those years ago, you must have assumed that society would improve and that you might need the centre going forward.
Certainly. I never thought that would get to this extent where we have so much people coming in, so much children. And one of the things that really saddens me, Miriam, to see the number of children coming in here every day, and then they're leaving the centre and going to a hotel for accommodation. I think at this day and age, it's absolutely appalling. And I appeal to the government, and I appeal to the government to build more homes. That is a huge problem. And that is why we have so many unfortunate homeless people, because the government are not building houses. They're not building homes. Each person should have their own home, should have a key to their own door. And that's not being done. Money is being wasted ridiculously otherwise, but not putting it into where they should be putting it for the unfortunate homeless people.
Dignity and respect, brother, it's so important to you. I think it's true, isn't it? You never ask anybody any questions when they come to the centre. Everyone is welcome.
Yes, and when the Holy Father was here over a year ago, one of the things he said to us was dignity and respect for each person. And that's what we are doing, and that's what we've been doing for the number of years since we started here. Yes, again, there was one occasion, all right, Miriam, a lady drove up in a car. And I happened to say to her, look, if you can afford a car, is there a reason for you to be coming here? Or should you be coming here at all? And she busted out crying and she said, this is my home. This is where I am living. I am living here with my little child in an old car. My husband has beaten the daylights out of me. And she showed me her hands and her feet. And since then, I have never, never asked anybody why they're coming here. It's like him in a Rolls Royce. They're still welcome. And I suppose that's one of the things that Holy Father St. Francis would want us to do as well, being a follower of St. Francis, to show kindness and compassion to the underprivileged.
Do you ever despair when you see all these people coming for help, Brother Kevin? I know you personally, and you're incredibly good-humoured, you're very mischievous, you're very funny. But do you ever despair?
I love to see the children coming, but it saddens me to think that they have to come to a centre, for a home centre for food. I despair when I think the way the government is behaving. That's what saddens me, Miriam. And I think that what I would say to them now, coming up to Christmas, please, please do something for the unfortunate children. And I don't want to see anybody lying or dying on the streets coming up to Christmas. The other morning, Miriam, a young girl came into the centre at 6:45. She had been out all night. She was only 20 years of age. She wasn't allowed into a hostel because she wasn't from Dublin and she didn't come into the catchment area. She slept alongside of some foreign nationals during the night. She said, he kept me warm. And she came in here freezing the cold. And thank God we were here to help her and to make sure that she had enough to eat. But again, the system is appalling, Miriam. And I hate saying this coming up to Christmas time. But we also have fantastic benefactors. And only for those, under no circumstances, will we be able to keep our lifeline in operation. Our running cost really would be about $4 million this year. And of that, we get $450,000 from the government. And then the generosity of the people who donate the remainder of it to us.
Why? Wow, so the overwhelming money that runs your centre for all these people, it's from donors, it's voluntary.
It's certainly, yes, yes. But I suppose the other, I remember there was one time, Miriam, I had no money at all and I was in a shocking state thinking what I was going to do. And now, this is what happened. I went down to the church and knelt in front of the Blessed Sacrament, And this is what I said. I said, God, these are your people, and if you want me to feed them, you better get the money. I have never gone short of money or food since then. So I do know there's a good God there, and he's keeping an eye on us and making sure that we won't let anybody go hungry.
You also give out food parcels, don't you?
We give out food parcels every Wednesday morning, and we'd have anything from 14 to 1500 for those. That's every Wednesday. And then on a Monday morning, we give out baby food and baby nappies, and we'd have about 300 families for those, maybe 300 to 350. And that's really what saddens me completely, Miriam, to see those people queuing up here on a Monday morning for baby food and baby nappies. It's absolutely appalling to think at this day and age we have to have that much poverty in our country.
And I suppose, Brother Kevin, to be fair, if a government representative was here, they would say to you, but Brother Kevin, we are building houses, we do give supports. I mean, is it possible, Brother Kevin, and this may sound harsh, that you can never eradicate homelessness or poverty?
Well, when they say they're building houses, they are building houses, but they're not building sufficient houses. What I would call on the government, get the Dublin City Council, get the councillors to build houses, and they provide the money and get the houses built, not going out to big developers who are really making a great go of it themselves. The people need homes, they need houses, and until such time that the government will really start building houses for the homeless, we will have a lot of unfortunate people on our streets.
Finally, Brother Kevin, what happens at Christmas with your centre?
On Christmas Day, Miriam, they all go to the RDS for dinner by the Knights of Columbanus, and all of our people, they go from here to the RDS and they all enjoy it. And I go there myself as well for about an hour or two to just to wish them all a happy Christmas and to be with them. Because I think Christmas is such a sad time for so many people. There was one occasion here in the centre on the Christmas Eve. There was a song on the radio, "It's Nice to Be Home for Christmas." And I happened to be going through the floor and this young man was there and the tears were streaming down his eyes. And I said to him, "Isn't that a beautiful song on the radio?" "Yes," he said. "It's a beautiful song," he said. "But at one time," he said, "I had a beautiful home and a beautiful wife and beautiful children. And here I am on Christmas Eve. I haven't got a home, a wife and children. So I'll probably be ending up on the streets for Christmas." And these are the things that sadden me, Miriam.
Brother Kevin, you're wondering, just to give out your website, you aren't asking me to do it, I want to do it. Anyone who's listening who may want to donate, it's capuchindaycentre.ie.
Yes. And the number is 872070.
That's come again, that's a Dublin number, isn't it?
01? 01, yes.
Give me the number again, Brother Kevin.
872070.
Brother Kevin, thanks so much as ever. You're wonderful. Keep going strong.
So, I wish everyone peace, hope and joy for Christmas, and especially the little children. We'll be having a party for them here in a few weeks' time, and we look forward to that great day to see the little children enjoying themselves.
Oh, Brother Kevin, you're such a joy and inspiration to speak to. Thank you so much, and a very happy Christmas to you, Brother Kevin.
And to you too, Miriam, and to your family.
Thank you very much. Take good care of yourself.
God bless.
And now we're joined in the studio again by Brona Gallagher. He's such a beautiful man, isn't he?
Beautiful man. Absolutely beautiful. Incredible work that they do every year. I've seen their work, and I know a lot of musicians as well get out in the streets at Christmas, and they do incredible work and incredible contributions from people. Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of these pivotal places are not properly funded. And like a lot of hospice worker friends of mine as well, you know, they're so like 18% funded by the governments, and it's a disgrace, because I think if people really deep down in people's hearts, people that are in a position to, if they really care, they can make a change. If they have the position of power and they have the access to the funds rather than spending it on all the stuff that we know we shouldn't be spending it on. If people really operate from compassion and not greed and a capitalist heart, they can make these changes that are needed, you know.
Now, do you like Christmas?
I do like Christmas. I think it can also be a time of great pressure. And just listening there to Brother, I really agree with that. It highlights a lot of stuff I think that people don't have. I think you have to be very careful around the Christmas because it is a time of comparison. And if you feel there's a lot lacking in your life, it can be very exaggerated by the Christmas season. Mm. But I do think it is something that I think everybody should have a wee bit of Christmas in their heart every day of the year, not just Christmas, that, you know, compassion and a sense of charity and, you know, not discriminating against people that don't have maybe what we think we, you know, people should have in order to survive. Asking those questions of people in the street. Why are you there? Have you got somebody to talk to? Do you need help? Can I help you get somewhere? So I think, you know, it should be something that we definitely need to just expand in our hearts every day, not just at Christmas time. But I do love it, and I love being around the children at Christmas. I definitely love that. I've got the most hilarious nieces and nephew. And that's
always
a good... Go to Derry. I've just been to Brighton to my four-year-old niece. That was a sort of pre-Christmas madness there. And no, I definitely always go home to the family at Christmas. It's a very important time.
And of course, you had such a busy year. Your film, A Bump Along the Way. You made that with your sister, didn't
you?
Yes,
Louise. She was a producer with NI Screen. And Tess McGowan, another Derry lady, wrote it. And Shelley Love.
Great film.
Yeah, it done really well. We were blown away by it. Yeah, and Element Pictures distributed it. So we were in great hands, yeah.
And you're as busy as ever. I know you're playing next Wednesday night in the Sugar Club.
Yeah.
Doors from 7:30. And there's a great DJ as well, Sally Foran, isn't there?
Yeah, DJ Sally Cinnamon is going to be playing the funk and the soul, another soul sister. So yeah, it'll be great fun. And then we'll sing all our hits.
And it's good value, €20 as well, from €20 for sugarclubtickets.com. Yeah. You're going to sing us out today. What are you going
to
sing?
We're going to sing another song, So the Story Goes, which actually is kind of... connected really to struggling financially, and that's about people that I knew were going through a really rough time. And it's basically, no matter how hard it is, you know, you really just have to ask for help, ask for support, never feel that shame, and to dig deep in your heart and have that courage to keep going. That's kind of what it's about.
Well, Brona, thanks so much as ever. You go back up and get ready to sing. You're accompanied as ever today by the great Conor Brady and Cian Boylan. My thanks today on sound to Cara O'Hare, to our producer, Sian O'Gorman. Thank you all very much for listening. We'll be here at the same time next Sunday. Until then, we'll go out listening to the great Brona Gallagher.
So the story goes, your troubles, nothing, put it in your pocket to see. Can't remember anything you said, won't forget how it made me feel. Oh, and I climb inside a moment, I'm never where I think I should be. Crashing all around, kicking it apart piece by piece. Can't control it, didn't know it. I got a selfish streak, it's the making of me. Lay it all out, call the gods down, ain't no higher power gonna pacify me. Oh, now head straight down, inside jaw, turn the time around. Does your heart beat right? Bless the reset, now you play it like you know it should be. So the story goes, counting at the money, nothing, put it in your pocket to see. Can't remember anything you say, won't forget how it made me feel. Oh, and I climb inside a moment, I'm never where I think I should be. Crashing all around, kicking it apart piece by piece. Out of harm's way, that's too easy. I got a warrior heart, it's the making of love me. From the nest down, I let the cat out. Caught the tailwind, baby, and it's pulling me right off of my knees. Head straight down, inside job, turn the time around. How's your heart beating now? Bless the reset, now you play it like you know what you'll be. So the story goes, counting out the troubles, not to put it in your pocket to see. Can't remember anything you say, won't forget how it made me feel. Oh, and I climb inside a moment, I'm never where I think I should be. Crashing all around, kicking it apart piece by piece. No more crashing all around, kicking it apart piece by piece. No more crashing all around, kicking it apart piece by piece.